And welcome back to another episode of Made to Cast. Today I have with me Mr. Lawrence Bendandy. I hope I'm saying it right, because I've known you long
enough. Bendandy.
Bendandy. See, the A-N, I would think Andy. Sounds more Italian.
Well,
there's
the English pronunciation and there's the Italian pronunciation. So I normally stick with sort of like the English version.
Okay. But anyways, Fish Whistle Lures, fantastic muskie bait maker, and truly one of the most organic meetings I've ever had in the bait making world was meeting this gentleman right here. So thank you for being here, Lawrence. I would look forward to sitting here and talking with you for a little bit.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I can't believe sort of that an incidental rental, kind of as you said, organic is probably the best way to kind of say it. And I got reprimanded from my wife when you came to my place because I was talking to our guests too much. And then especially when I think it was maybe an anniversary excursion for you guys. Yeah. And you talked to them for that long during your, and it's their anniversary. Get out of there.
So as a little backstory for what we're talking about is Emily and I, after I think probably it might have been 8 or 9 years, we decided that we were going to get rid of the kids to have one anniversary away. Like we'd never left the kids since my youngest, like for any substantial amount of time, just because we felt guilty like pawning them off on people. But we said, finally, let's go for our anniversary. Let's look for something. But I said, I want somewhere on the water. I was a couple of years into making lures. I had some baits I wanted to test, and our anniversary is in June. So I wanted to get out and throw some baits. And I had developed a couple of them and I brought them with me. And I mean, sorry, to backtrack, we looked on Airbnb and your place came up. And I remember going back and forth and seeing the place. I'm like, this is perfect. This is awesome. And as soon as we pulled up, beautiful property right on the water. And we're looking out at the water. And all I can think about is I want to get out there to test my baits. I want to test some baits. And we met your wife and she was just talking about it. And I think my wife had mentioned that I make baits and he kind of just wants to get out to throw them for our anniversary. That's what he wants to do. And your wife goes, oh, really? And super passively, my husband makes baits. And I thought, really? And she goes, yeah, Fish Whistle Lures. I don't know if you ever heard of it, but he's out right now when he comes back. And fast forward a little bit, we had a TiVo issue in our little room and she sent you out to fix it. And I remember standing there and being like, how do I organically bring up that I make lures and I'd like to talk about it? Because I'm a sucker for that kind of thing. And I remember it was you after a few minutes that were saying, you said something about, oh yeah, you make lures. And I felt almost like you might have been a little skeptical about, like, what do you really do? And then I spent the next... was it two nights we were there, whatever it was,
yeah,
trying to talk to you about bait making and musky fishing.
Well, my hold back or whatever sensitivity you might have said that I might have been was more because I was afraid of my wife. and I get accused for talking too much and too long. And did you let him say what he wanted to say, or was it just you all one-sided? I think it was a 50-50 shot, but I'm not really sure.
Well, I mean, so. And so, I mean, for those that obviously don't understand, Lawrence has had a Airbnb right on the water
we still
have it. Okay. Yeah. There was an incident a couple of years ago or a year ago now, whenever it was. And there was a little setback to that, but when we were there,
well, we can kind of state to as part of maybe self promotion a little bit with regards to the Airbnb. We did have a serious house fire, not to the Airbnb where you stayed, mm-hmm. but to the main building. A lot of damage, mostly smoke. Well, I don't know how you say mostly, but anyway, we haven't been there since basically a year and a half.
Yeah.
So it's supposed to be completed in August. I don't think I'll have the Airbnb running by then, but we've ex actually extended it. So I don't know if you remember that larger deck that was
Yep. The elevated one.
So above where you were staying, so that's now going to be a second spot. So we've actually mo probably more than doubled. So it'll be Phoenix rising out of the ashes, hopefully.
That's amazing. So it was a beautiful place, and I mean,
Thank
I'll
you.
make sure that you can plug everything, like the name of it and everything, for anybody. Because listen, for anybody that we're going to get into musky fishing a bit, all fishing, but musky fishing, and he's in a very nice spot to just be able to kind of get out and cruise a little bit. So if anybody's ever in Ontario, Southern Ontario, looking for Airbnbs, especially one that's on the water, that is a beautiful place, and you get to talk to just a super friendly guy.
Well, I try. I have to kind of correct a little bit because it is more Lake Scugog. Apparently, at one point, anyways, was one of the most productive lakes in southern Ontario. It's probably best known for its bass fishing, and then unfortunately, the walleye fishing has been there's a moratorium on them because they're having population issues. But the crappie fishing is phenomenal. The carp fishing is unbelievable. I've
Out of this
had
world.
some of the top carp fishermen in Canada come by, and we've had customers while they were fishing carp had to pull their rods out of the water because they were catching too much and it was disrupting. They were watching Champions League soccer, and it was disrupting their final the view of the final because their beepers kept going off. So, and then the muskie population, potentially from the improving crappie population, has been getting bigger and bigger as well. So.
But I mean, that's a, I'm glad you brought up the carp fishing, because carp fishing to me was always like boring fishing. It was just like sucker fishing. Like you just throw a line in and you just dead. But you guys do it from, and this is my perspective, like a European carp fisher, like when I see online, like because they're huge into carp fishing over there. And like,
Well, yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt, but from my understanding, carp fishing is the largest sport fish in the world. So it's almost non-existent in Canada. I know the boys at Fishing Canada are trying to promote it more and more. I think it's a phenomenal opportunity for Canada's visitors and drawing people from around the world to come as guests, because I think, with the St. Lawrence and the Great Lakes, I think there's a great chance that we might even have a world record, but hardly anybody fishes for them. And like my friend and I that lives in my neighborhood, we just started fishing because it started as an accident. We were trying to clean our shoreline, and somebody at one of the fishing shows that I was at as a fish whistles lure sales guy said the best way to clean your shoreline is just to throw corn out, and the carp will come around and they'll clean up the weeds. But so many came by, and I said to my friend that is an avid fisherman all around, I said, we should try to fish for these things. And we very quickly, without even knowing what we were doing, were just catching giants. So, like the one night, probably our best night out, we probably caught over 1,000 pounds of carp.
And I that and that that was kind of Emily and I's experience as well, which was we went there to just kind of hang out. And the first night that we were there, we were there 2 nights. And the first night you had walked, we were just sitting by a fire. You said, "Oh, there's a fire down by the water. Go sit by the." And so we're sitting there. And you would come by me and you're like, "Have you ever carp fish?" And I'm like, "Not on purpose." Like thinking almost jokingly, like, "Yeah, of course I haven't carp fished." And you're like, "Oh, do you want me to set up? I'll put the setup out and I'll show you." And I kind of not laugh, but I was like, "Oh, I'm intrigued, like a setup." And then, but I've watched a few European guys with the like the slingshot shooting food out in the water and all that stuff. So I knew what you were bringing out, and I'm like, oh, this is cool to see it in person. So then Emily went and I went back. Once you baited everything and everything was good, we sat back down, and she'll still talk today about hearing the like of the monitor,
the bite detector, the line,
and her jumping up, and I'm like, get it, and she latched into that first one, and she pulled in maybe, let's say it was a 8 or 9 pound fish.
Yeah,
an absolute riot for about 15 minutes of watching her try to pull, because it's out front of your property, it's maybe 5-6 feet deep, maybe, but for like 30 feet. So they can run shallow. So you see the wakes, you see them breaking, and there are like pit bulls on the end of your fishing line.
Well, the average, I don't know how much of the listeners know anything about carp fishing, but they have relatively soft lips, kind of almost like human lips. And you can't horse them in like you can with a bass,
right?
Or, you know, because the hook can relatively easily pull out.
Right.
So you have to let them run and you have to fight them. Right. And for those that don't know carp and are maybe concerned about it, there's extremely durable fish, or they can stay out of water. Somebody told me even a half an hour, and you put them back in and they'll survive. You know, the opposite end of the spectrum from muskies, where we have to be so gentle with them because, you know, they will die in a sense relatively easily.
Right.
So if the tug is your drug kind of thing for fishing, if you're, you know, a fish isn't available right now because carp in Canada don't have a season, you can fish for them year round. One of the guys that I work with is also a carp guide, Andrew Walker. He's out of Quebec.
Okay.
But they're just, yeah, so you can fight them as long as you want. And they're just a phenomenal fish as an option outside or something for you to try.
And kind of like with any fish, there's kind of special things, but there's one thing about carp that I've learned, I mean, through watching people, and that there's one elusive type. And I mean, you've got one under your belt. I've seen the pictures, at least one. But carp have got these giant, giant armor plates on them, for those that don't know. Like they're scales. They're like shields. They're big discs. And then every once in a while, you'll get what they call a mirrored carp.
Yeah.
And you guys got them in Scugog.
We have a lot. We have a lot. I think from, well, the initial part of it anyways, I didn't mean to interrupt again, but it seems like about 10% of our catches or thereabouts are mirror carp. And like in England and a number of other places in the world, it's kind of like in musky fishing, to relate it to something that I know more about, it's kind of like catching tiger.
Okay.
Tiger musky, so a lot of people, maybe even on an entire fishing career, and never catch a tiger.
Right. You know,
it may not be quite that rare with mirrors, but we have some enormous mirrors that we've caught.
Right. Yeah, no, it's like a gamble almost. Like you get that opportunity to get one, and you never know what you're going to pull up, right? Like, and that's what's so exciting about it. You might get that. Again, it's just like that lottery fish that you win and you're like, oh, I got one. Like, it just adds a little more fun because, like you said, you might get a 12, 13, 14, 15 pounder that is just like, they're powerhouses. Like, that is an enormous fish. That's so crazy.
We just need to do a quick audio reset here. There's clearly a disconnect on Lawrence's line. So we're just getting that straightened out, and we are back with the program.
We get these giant powerhouses, and that's what kind of brings me to the whole point of us being there in the first place. We weren't expecting about the whole carp situation. That was a beautiful little extra that we got on our trip. But what I really wanted to get you on here for, and really wanted to grind you about was learning, because you, when after the first day when we were able to talk a little bit, you were like, maybe you'd be interested in seeing this. And you brought out two things. You brought out a lure, and you brought a plastic or a laminated magazine cover with that lure in that magazine color, and thought, you said, you might find this interesting. And that kind of set off the tone of where our, I want to say friendship, kind of really developed. Because I was like, okay, like we're, it's not just like you're throwing together a couple things and whatever.
Yeah.
And I think you really could understand that I wasn't just somebody who was doing just little tiny things. Like I feel like we were both interested and invested in the same thing. And
I picked up that you seemed to be passionate about it. But I mean, like I mentioned before, I didn't want to be disruptive to your trip by talking fishing the whole time.
Right.
Because as much as I didn't know you, I didn't know your wife as well. And she was, I think, my memory, enjoying the sunshine or the sunset. I can't remember which. And I think she was reading a magazine. But then was she reading the magazine because she's annoyed about this strange guy that came down and is disrupting, you know, my time with my husband? Or she was just relaxed. You know, I didn't really know. And then I had, you know, the little angel of my own wife going, get out of there, get out of there.
Well, that was the problem, is I would see you walking down and I'd be like, okay, I got make this, like, just try to make this conversation. Because I felt like I was interrupting you. So I was like,
oh, no, it wasn't that at all.
Because Emily's used to me. Emily's used to me that if it's a topic that I'm into, like fishing, she just knows it's a lost battle. Like, it doesn't matter. I'm talking someone's ear off. So, but you had showed me at the time just a musky bait. I knew nothing about musky baits. I know now that it was your custom musky bait called the Magician.
The jitterwalker.
The jitterwalker is what you showed me, and it kind of built this friendship that we had. So what I'd like to do is, and I do this to everybody, is I try to find anybody who comes on here, their kind of origin story. What got you into bait making? How did this become a thing for you?
The honest truth, I didn't really know. And then since I agreed to do the podcast, I've been thinking about it over and over. And I think to me, the lure making ended up being an extension of me trying to understand this fish of 10,000 casts and how do I go about catching more of them when I've caught so few. I guess it's about 3 years or so, I think, ago. I found it today that the first video that I posted on the Jitterwalker was in 2015. So, my goodness, it's going to be 8 years this year that this lure has been out and about. And I'd already been fishing, I think, a few years for muskies. I hadn't really caught that many. But anyway, that's how it started. It was an extension of me trying to figure out the dynamic nature that fishing, I think, for all species really is. Where are they? What are they doing? When are they doing it? And I think top water, just because it's so visual, obviously, it was the area that spoke most to me.
Right.
And so I started whittling on I don't even really remember consciously buying this balsa wood with the mission, I'm going to make a lure. I just remember whittling away at this piece of wood and then realizing actually even halfway through it, I messed up here. The lure that I'm making is actually way bigger than this piece is. What am I going to do? And then it's like, oh, I'll make a jointed bait. Yeah, that way I'll be able to make the full size of what the head part of it is.
Right.
And it was as many years ago that
part of the story for me is, I remember vividly kind of watching a Patriots game, and they were talking about, you know, how Tom Brady probably doesn't have very much time left in his career. And that had to be like 2013 or 14. And he just quit last year. So
right.
The passage of time is kind of a strange thing. So, and then, Where does this kind of inspiration kind of come? I don't really know, but I mean the first Jitterwalker that I made is about 95% of where it is today. You know, I made the original out of balsa, knowing that I planned to do it with resin because I didn't have the means or the allocated funds to get into the woodworking side of bait making,
right,
that I guess I had kind of started to look on YouTube and other areas to kind of educate myself. And I goes, oh, well, that's a lot more than I can take on. And then focusing on muskies, bucktails are probably, you know, in the flash side of it was, it's probably the most popular bait, but I didn't really understand the lure. I didn't really understand what's the difference between this one and that one.
Right.
They all look the same to me at a variety of different prices, from the store-bought musky killer at $15 to the custom guy that is selling them for unbelievable prices, let's just say.
Right.
So this kind of spoke to me. It just seemed to be easy, black and white. You cut it, it floats. Yes. Does it make a plop, plop, plop sound? It did. And then it kind of worked. And then from there, I don't even really remember all of the time frame stuff, but there was, because like there were so many different people that kind of came into play. I guess this is kind of like networking. I try to speak to as many people as possible. I try to show it to as many people as possible. I think one of the first guides or reputable people that I knew that I saw was at a Muskies Canada meeting, and it's John Anderson, that is a phenomenal guide. He speaks to me very much because I think he comes from a science perspective on how he approaches his musky fishing. And anyway, I showed him this black lure, one of the first ones that I made out of resin, and his eyes glaze over and is like, oh God, here's another guy trying to show me the latest and greatest. This is going to do it all. So while I'm trying to keep a conversation going, but in the back of my mind, I'm going, if I send him one of these lures, it's just at best going to end up on a bench somewhere and probably possibly just in the in the garbage bin after he opens the box.
Right.
So the honest truth, I was a little less than excited about it. But around that time, I think it was just from a few posts on my Facebook page, I got an unbelievable phone call from, his name is Paul, I can't pronounce his last name properly, probably, Didascalou. He makes PDs, inline baits out of the Ottawa region, and ended up having this impromptu seminar on the business of bait making on my birthday, probably about 2014 or 15. This guy out of the blue, and I don't think I've ever been able to express to him how thankful I was for that, for somebody that, you know, was an established bait maker in the market to kind of give me this round, literally business seminar on musky baits. And we agreed that you know, to do a bait exchange. I sent him three or four of mine, and he sent me a bunch of his amazing baits. And it ends up being a long story here, but it's a I think it's something that any bait maker out there that may, especially if they're just starting, is to never discount anybody.
Yeah, for sure.
And so I sent him some of my baits. He gave one or two of the baits that he received from me to his veterinarian because he's a Muskie fan. And then the veterinarian ended up hiring John Anderson a year or so later or something to that effect. And I know the story because John Anderson ended up he used to put out a blog. Whether or not he does still, I'm not really sure. But he tells a story about how this gentleman came on his boat. He was excited about the bait that he had gotten from his friend slash, you know, bait maker. And it's something that I also at that time didn't appreciate so much about how many of the guides, they have their program for the fishing day. And their job is to put fish in the boat. And they're not going to just try something willy-nilly, which is how he perceived my bait initially. Yes. And he actually, I guess, kind of had recognized it and remembered it from seeing it, you know, 6 months to a year earlier. It wasn't the best of fishing days. Things weren't really working out. Luckily, the gentleman asked, well, should we put on that bait that I wanted to try? And he said, sure, let's just shot in the dark. And then he went, you know, we went from swatting flies to taking pictures, I believe was the line that he said. They ended up catching, I think, two or three pike and at least two or three muskies that day. So it ended up being a topwater day. They liked the black topwater, and he gave me a call the next day. Remember that bait you were going to send me? You know, do you mind sending it along? And I was like, in my mind, oh, yeah, I got it the next couple of days.
That's
and
right.
I hadn't even started really making it for him because, again, I was less than excited about making a bait that would just end up in on a bench.
Right.
So that is sort of like really – you know, the origin, is it me making it or was it John putting it on the line in a good area where he knew there was muskies
right.
You know, making the day for one of his clients. And that's, I would probably say, the highlight of my quote-unquote fishing career. I've been lucky enough to get some decent fish, but receiving that picture from the gentleman with the first customer catch, probably the greatest pleasure that I've received in the fishing area. So then not only was I hooked on muskie fishing, but I was, I think, doubly so caught on, stuck on, whatever, on making baits.
Making them. Yeah. That's the... And I mean, I think a lot of people in the business or industry could speak to that same story where like that bite of not necessarily them catching, but the first other person to catch on their bait. And it's just getting that picture. And for me still randomly, just I'll get a picture, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And the next morning I wake up and I got it and my day is made. Like it's.
For sure.
It's. It speaks so much to what we're able to do. And I mean, that whole story, it's got a lot to it because it plays on the emotion as well that like you wanted to put yourself out there to somebody who saw you at the time as just another guy. And I think like I still have that battle even today, like when we just did the Can Cash show. Like it's everybody that walks through the booth, I feel the same way. I have that same like I'm putting myself out there to someone who thinks I'm just another guy. Do you know what I mean? Like
oh for sure. It was a massive leap of faith and really you know, a leap, I think, is the best way that I can say it because it felt like you're jumping out into this void. And it was actually massively deflating to kind of see his eyes glaze over.
Right.
But I kind of had to soldier through. Like, I was working as a sales rep at the time and had enough experience to realize that sometimes these things turn around, even though that it feels like I'm losing this sale.
Yes. Yeah.
This is going south. This is going south fast. And it was actually even more kind of like bizarre that sale, and it had happened in sales as well. They come to fruition 6 months later when you least expect it.
Right.
Like that phone call from John saying, you know, we've got some fish and I really want to work it. And then that's another thing that I didn't appreciate at that time. While John Anderson's catching fish, he's going to post some pictures and I'm going to sell a million of these things. Not fully appreciating the fact that a lot of times when guides have a new hot lure, you know, they keep it to themselves.
It's the opposite effect.
Yeah, it's, in a sense, really. It's almost like it made no effect. But then right. again, the long, convoluted story, and hopefully I get to mention all of the various people that have kind of come into play on success or whatever it is, at whatever state I'm at right now. While he didn't promote it from his standpoint, the next year, I knew he was going to be one of the speakers at Muskie Sunday, which for me, it kind of kicks off the muskie season in a sense. It's in February at the fishing show. And Muskies Canada does a great seminar where they get a lot of times some of the biggest names in the muskie world to tell us, you know, or show us or explain, you know, what is the best approaches for us to go catch these elusive fish. And he was there, so I wanted to give him another few of these baits. The original one, as I mentioned earlier, was jointed, and I made a solid version, you know, that fishes a little bit differently. And he says, you know what? It's only February. How about you give this one to Gord Pizer, you know, get me one. It looks great and everything, whatever. I was excited, did really well with it last year, but give it to Gord and, let's see where that'll go. So Gord took it again with nominal. Again, he's super busy. He's
yes.
regarded potentially as maybe the best multi-species fisherman in Canada. Oh, okay. John Anderson sent you over. Okay, so I'll give it a shot. And then I really didn't. I heard back from him again about 6 months later, and he says, well, I'm going to go fishing with this gentleman that I fish with all the time. We both like throwing top water. It's on Lake of the Woods, and they were actually fishing with a guide that my carp fishing friend, who's I think muskies are his favorite, my friend Andrew. I'll leave the last name out. But the guide, here we got it here, Darcy Cox on Lake of the Woods, probably known as one of the top guys up there. And I'd already sent them some baits through my friend Andrew. Again, don't hear from Gord again until like November of the year. It's probably 2017. And he goes, I want to put it in the magazine. You go, what magazine? What are you talking about?
Right.
Like, you know, he was almost like talking another language. I want to put it in the Outdoor Canada magazine for you know, topwater lure. Again, it was just I never imagined anything like that. And so it came out in the bait review in 2018 as his choice for the top musky pike topwater lure for the year. And you know, it basically left me speechless. It was, and then subsequently he's mentioned it on a number of podcasts as his favorite topwater lure for pike, muskie. I mean, and, to have somebody like that think these things, it was beyond anything I could have imagined or even dreamed of when I was whittling away at that piece of wood that was too small for the lure that I had imagined.
Right. But I mean, and that story, like, I mean, I love that story. And I get the benefit of talking to you every once in a while. I want to say short conversations, but I don't think you and I have ever had a short conversation. Matter of fact,
no.
At the end of this podcast, it might be the shortest conversation that we've ever had. But
like, I think either one of us is not capable of a short conversation.
But that, for those that don't know, you got definitely got to go check out Lawrence's page to check out the lure he's talking about. I'm going to post it in my stories, and I'll post it with this on Made to Cast Instagram. But the jitterwalker that he's talking about, it looks like a jitterbug on steroids with like skirt on the side, and it's a big, beautiful lure. But this is what I'm getting at, and I want to just take a sub note here from muskies for a minute, because I've had this hard on for muskie over the last little bit. But for all my guys that are looking for like those big, beautiful topwaters for those big southern bass blow ups, and this lure is it's around 8 inches.
I think it's not an 8 or 9 inches. Well, it depends on like the body of it is probably like 7.5, but then the tail skirting is a little bit longer.
Right. But let's just say between 8 and 9. That doesn't scare anybody off. But it's like, it's a huge topwater bait. And Lawrence has always been building for muskie.
Well, huge. I have to qualify for, because muskie guys listening won't see it as huge.
Right.
Bass
right.
guys might see it as huge.
And that's the problem, is that bass guys are like, I'm throwing 12-inch glide baits. Like, don't worry about a 9-inch topwater walker. But it's a killer bait. And again, Lawrence has always marketed it as a muskie bait, but we just had a conversation not even a week ago, and we were talking about this, and I'm telling you guys, if you just pay attention to those big bass guys that are always talking about topwaters, I've been asked about topwaters, if I make big topwaters. This topwater, it's designed to take a 50-plus inch muskie blow up. It's going to take your 14-pound largie that's blowing up on Lake Fork. Take a look at these things. I guarantee you they'll wet your whistle, your fish whistle. But there's a lot to be said, because I think subconsciously in our head, we put ourselves into these categories. I'm a bass bait builder. I'm a musky bait builder. But you take that label off, and there's so much crossover between the two.
I try not to. I don't speak to bass, because I am ignorant of bass. But I mean, when I was first testing it, I caught, you know, it had to be pretty close to 5 pounds largy that came off my dock. So I don't market it to the bass guys, because I'm ignorant of it. I can't speak their lingo. But I've been dying to get a bass guy that fishes big bass water, because I don't see why it wouldn't go. I gave it to, one of my nephews that was down in Florida, and he said, a big alligator gar took his lure.
That's cool.
So, you know, and then set up for bass. He didn't have any kind of leader, so away it swam. I'm in no illusion, you know. I would love to the thing is, that was, I've looked at more and more at the bass world, because as you said, these big swim baits that you guys have, and I think Gord even wrote an article to the effect that those baits are underutilized in the muskie market.
Yep.
And that's why, going back to meeting you and seeing your swim baits, I go, oh my God, any predatory fish would take your lures, and I was excited to be able to fish them. So,
you're the one that opened my eyes to that, because like I built them for bass fishing, and I mean any multi species for me, but for bass fishermen, and that's kind of the world that I had my head into. But you're the one that was like, you understand that this would. You open my eyes to the musky bait world. Like I've known what musky are. I know how guys fish for them and some like the look of the baits. I don't know everything about them, but you had said like you had brought up. I don't want to get into the nuance of our conversations, but like just design aspects and things that people think about versus reality and all these things. But when I brought up the glide bait, I said to you like that's a good point. It's a big bait that you can get into different. Like water columns and work that column. Why isn't there more of them? And I remember we were just talking, it's basically just like, cause it hasn't yet. And with you saying that, like maybe 5 or 6 months later, Gord wrote an article about glide baits being an underutilized, fishing or like marketings, or fishing.
And even to this day, really the bigger brands are, I think there's, one or two really jointed swim bait that is out there, but I don't think they're really being used. And you know, it's as fishy as can be. It looks like your lures look as real as it can be. So if they look that real, if a muskie will eat a pounder, you know, a big rubber bait with this unrealistic tail, why wouldn't they actually look something that actually looks like a walleye or actually looks like a bass?
Right.
So it's just a question of knowledge on the fisherman side of things of putting it in water that they swim.
Like to me though, like when I thought, because I've been thinking about muskie a lot, and I think a lot of it has to do with just the fact that like you kind of alluded to it, especially at the beginning, fish with like 1,000 casts, 10,000 casts. Guys want to utilize every single one of those casts. Like, so I've had people because for those that don't know, with my new HC Ono that I'm starting to roll out, Lawrence has been behind so much of it. And that's just with conversation, kind of picking his brain about the musky world. He's put me onto a bunch of amazing people, fishers, guides, testers that are going to be helping me out. And like, I'm forever thankful for you. But when we were talking about the actual design of the bait, my biggest concern was that there's musky guys know that it's so hard to catch a musky that every single cast has to count. Like the one guy I was talking to said, if you foul out on a musky bait, some guys won't throw that more than 3 or 4 times if it fouls out when you cast it, because then you foul the cast. You got to drag that in and reset it. Right. They want like perfect casts every time. Like, there's so many things to think about that I think that if you go, hey, try this guide bait, they're like, or glide bait, they're like, why am I wasting a cast? I know what'll work. And they don't want to like, and I'm not saying all of them, I'm not painting a big brush, but guys that like myself who might only have one day to go out or like in a weekend, like I don't have the ability to go out every single day or all weekend, or, you know, I'm trying to make my fishing count for those people. To be like, hey, try a glide bait for musky this weekend. They might not bite at it, right?
I think that is definitely one of the minutiae of it. I think it's definitely much more of an issue on the side of again that group that I suggested you speak to, because those guys when they're casting, they know there's fish there.
Right.
So a foul cast is going to screw up the very real opportunity. Your average fisherman, I think, is crossing his fingers at most casts, so they would find it less irritating. If it happened on a regular basis, then it would kind of. But I mean, I think a lot of times they would blame themselves for a foul cast. But I mean,
right.
If you're trying to get the endorsement of the good guys, but that's kind of one of the things when you're prototyping with people like that, and they keep throwing it and they like it, then you've tested that bait both for its fish catching abilities and its its credibility out in the market, where people, if they do foul cast, then they'll know more it's their fault because Mr. X super guide said it's a good bait. So then it's got to be on me why it's not performing like it should.
Right.
So it's kind of like a twofold or multidimensional, reason why you get tested with those things.
Those guys that you were talking about that you had introduced me to, like, that's one of, I don't want to say it is an asset, but networking and then coming across someone like yourself, because I'm not going to say everybody in the community is like this, but what I'm going to say is that there are people in this community, and I try to be that person. I try to be like a middleman when I can be, but you make baits. You have your own baits you're trying to promote when you do. And I know, like, with the fire and everything, you've been down and you haven't been able to, but you have your own, not an agenda, but like you have an own guideline of like what you're doing, what you're building. And like, I had called you a bunch of times. I texted you a bunch of times about the development of this musky bait. And like, never once was it, oh, well, you know what? That's coming close to what I make. Or, like, ooh, I don't want to tell. You've been like, okay, well, this is why this wouldn't work when I did it. And you were very open with like, oh, when I've never done that, but this is why I do this way. And then you were like, you had said you really want to try to get it into guys that are going to use it. And I said, yeah, that's a good point, but like, where do I even start? And I made a joke, and I was actually laughing out loud with my wife when we talked about it, because I had said to you, like, who would I talk to? And you're like, oh, I'll introduce you to somebody. And like within like 5 minutes, and this isn't an exaggeration, within 5 minutes, I was in a group message with five, arguably, of the bigger names in musky fishing in Canada. I'll say in Ontario, but some couple aren't in Ontario. But that's just, it's a testament to you, but it's a testament to what I think the fundamentals of the bait making community can be. Like, there's a lot of secrets. There's a lot of, I get that. There's a lot of trial. There's a lot of things that we try to keep ourselves relevant and keep it, individual when we do things. But your freedom of information is what I think when somebody new gets into the scene, if they meet you versus if they meet X, Y, or Z, you're going to get two different outcomes of like the progression of that person going forward in bait making. Because like, you have hope. Like I said, when I talked to you, when your house burnt down, I knew you as like the Airbnb guy, because I'm pretty sure when I showed Emily, I said, hey babe, look at this, was the Airbnb we stayed at when you posted a picture of it. So like, our relationship that's grown even since then has been, it's just, you know what I mean? Like, this is the biggest thing for me. Baits are awesome. I love building them. I love the catch pictures, but I've gotten some, what I would like consider friendships, like on a friendship level, of people I talk to. Like, I don't talk to you on Instagram. I pick up the phone. I call your number because texting, try to have this conversation through Instagram text. Like, you can't do it.
Instagram isn't so much my thing for some reason. I don't really get, I don't know. It doesn't flow for me. They say Facebook is the old guy's thing, so that seems to speak to me
but,
more.
But just through text, we can't have these conversations through text. I take your number, I'm calling you, and we're going to talk for 45, 50 minutes. And like, but that's what I think is such a huge fundamental in this business. And there's more and more people all the time that I'm getting in my like circle of people that I can talk to. But you in general have been such a driving force behind this HCONO that I'm starting to put out.
Well, thank you.
No, thank you. Like it's been awesome to be able to.
Well, I get like a gratification. Like if you get the next giant fish that you see a picture of it, if I had a milligram of effort towards it, it's my way of kind of paying it forward from some of the, like Paul that I mentioned earlier at PD's. I'm going to mention them now because it seems appropriate. The guys that were good to me, Sean Marr is his name, a hoser from Hose Baits. He was a little, like you mentioned before, some of these guys have been a little bit protective of their thing. I think it was more so, is it somebody that's coming into the market gung-ho and, you know, a flash in the pan, is not really serious about what he's doing or not? But then there's another bucktail maker, Mike Parker, that makes the handlebars. And he's right at the top of some of the super nice guys that he wasn't so much in the bait making side of things, because he made bucktails that I said at the time I didn't really understand. Right. But because he'd been so nice to me, I'd bought his materials. I wanted to give him one for free just for being a good guy. And then when I gave him one of my baits, I'd forgotten about it, but he made a post about it or shared one of my first posts that he had gotten one and that he was excited about fishing it. And that doesn't happen too often, you know, especially from a well-established maker like himself. And then what I wanted to say earlier, I wanted to emulate the good guy in the industry from Mike Parker, Mike Nobilsi, that does a water wolf lures that a lot of people will know, the Shadzillas and the Ratzillas, and his phenomenal tubes as well. He another super, super guy in the industry, that, you know, always got a smile on his face. And I have, you know, and it's, I think I start from a philosophy that high tides raise all ships. Yep. So if we popularize this musky craziness, there's enough room for everybody.
Sure.
There will be times when the Jitterwalker is the right lure, and there'll be other times where the handlebars or a hose bait or, you know, the PDs or, you know, the Rover baits, another phenomenal rubber baits by Landry Smith, that has proven himself another just top-notch individual that I try to emulate more their approach to the industry, to the business, to fishing, to making baits, and just trying their best at doing what they do and doing it with a smile and realizing that we're not, you know, we're not brain surgeons, right, in the sense, not even the difficulty of the making of it, but I mean the seriousness of what, right, we do. This is about spare time. It's not about critical issues. Right. And then especially in the time that we're all facing right now, or we were with the pandemic, with more serious issues, it's effing fishing, you know. It's not
right,
you know. So a lot of time, because I have been involved with a few other bait makers, that it turned out to be less than a positive experience.
Yes, definitely.
And I've talked to a few guys off the ledge that they were, you know, they were being accused of copying baits. I think you've talked about it with other guys on your podcast about this, that kind of stuff. And like, to me, the message to that individual and to others, and maybe people that are just starting, because they don't, may not even know where their inspiration is coming from. We're all trying to copy fish.
Right.
Like we were alluding to, your swim baits, they look like fish. So it's got to work. As long as it's a good fisherman putting it in water and following, you know, Gore Pizer said, you know, 90% of fish are in 10% of the water. So the key element is
finding,
for the non-bait maker, but for the fisherman that is listening, maybe newer, is try to find out where these things are, because whatever you regard as the best lure in the world, if there's no fish around, it ain't going to get bit.
Right. I mean, with that being said, and there are, I do have quite a few listeners that are non-bait makers, and that's one thing that I've been asked before, and one of the segment things that I was asked to talk about, and I'm not going to make a full segment, but I do want to bring it up, is like when you get a custom bait that doesn't work, like what's the proper etiquette? So I don't know about etiquette. What I would say is your first reaction shouldn't go to be on a forum and blast the builder. There's a million things that could be a problem solver. That's a 1 second thing. Your first thing to do if you're really at a standstill is contact the maker. I would say 90% of makers would bend over backwards just to make sure that the bait you got works. I'm not going to say all of them, but
yeah,
there's literally a piece of me that leaves every time I send something out. To think that's broken, it's almost unacceptable, right? And I would feel really bad for it. So reach out to me, let me know. And I want to say that anybody, another big one is like Kyle with Throwback Baits. He makes big bass baits. Like, his reputation is fantastic for like something breaks, he fixes it. He like, you know what I mean? He's such a personable guy, and he sells tons of them. Like, it's, you would think like, oh, only the guys that sell three or four, but this guy sells tons of baits, and he's super personal. He's like on Instagram, he talks to you, like such a great dude. And I think that people are so quick to go to a forum and be like, oh, this bait sucks. When it comes to a personal bait or a handmade bait, they're not factory tuned. They're hand tuned by the maker.
Yeah.
And we do everything in our power to make them run in our very specific areas, wherever, if it were a lake, whatever. But most baits, for those that don't know, can simply be tuned by adjusting the line tie eyelet. A little torque left or right will often prevent a bait from kicking out one way or another. It'll run true to itself. But there's more than that. Like, if you want to put a little bit of a lead strip tape, like lead tape on the belly of a bait, you can get it to suspend a little bit if you have a floating bait and you want it to suspend. Custom baits are so much more than just, I mean, you can do this with store-bought baits for sure, but like, there's solutions to a custom bait problem if it's a problem for you. And I think that the best thing to do is A, have fun with it. It's a custom bait. You can, now, I spent $200 on this bait. Reach out to the maker. The maker will solve the problem. But his response might be like, get a little piece of lead tape, put it right on the, like right behind the joint, and that'll straighten everything out for you. It could be such a simple
thing. Yeah, there's so many things that actually comes up with the second bait that made it into the Outdoor Canada magazine, The Magician. I didn't appreciate actually factors outside of the bait itself, with the leader and the line and the rod that is working the bait,
right.
and how, because the Magician, and I called it that because it can walk the dog and it can be a dive rise at the same time. But I sent it out, one of the baits that I tuned because it was going to an influential individual, and I go, this thing's got to work. It's got to be no questions asked. And to this day, I thought it worked perfectly. You know, I had three or four of them that I had brought up to my friend's cottage, with in mind that it's going to get shipped to them. And to my mind, it worked perfectly. And when he got it, he couldn't get it to work. He wanted it. His primary interest in the two abilities that the lure had was it for the walk of the dog. And I don't understand. We tried and we, how about this solution, that solution, more weight, less weight, bigger hook in the front, a little smaller hook in the back, combinations of all of the above. And for some reason, to this day, I don't know whether or not I can't explain it. So it's almost like, it comes into my mind, with the promotion or marketing of the bait do I even say that it walks the dog? Because that it's a very finicky thing, balance, that to be able to do, be on top and to also be diving. Yes. And again, we were talking before about, I think the skill set that the fisherman has, I don't even know if it was a private conversation or was a part of the podcast earlier. Does the, oh yeah, you were saying with the foul casting, is it foul casting because the guy doesn't know how to use a bait caster, a musky rod, whatever that style of, you know, rod that is required to be casting that bait, or there's an issue with the bait itself?
Right.
But I mean, do please contact me directly first and I'll send a replacement. I'll send you a different lure. You know, I make more than just those two baits now. I'll refund your money if you don't like it. You know, I've heard other podcasts as well. Like I think it was the guys from the Musky 360 podcast. They sent the lures back, and because it had, you know, this slight erratic nature to it, but they knew the lure and they knew how to do it, you know, they worked it to a 50 plus fish,
right?
You know,
right.
So
but that's just and I think that's, and again, this person wasn't necessarily saying like my bait or your bait or anybody's bait in particular. They're just saying if you bought a bait from the store, it doesn't work, it just sits in your tackle box or you get rid of it. But that's a four, you know, at a high end, that's a $35 lure. Someone goes and spends $150, $200 on a custom bait. Like, what's the etiquette behind it? I think that's what he was referring to. And
right.
My first step is, again, I make it, so I say, well, have fun with it. Try to adjust it. But you don't want to break anything. Reach out to the person that sent it to you and say, listen, this is supposed to be, you said that this was this style of bait. I unfortunately can only make it. Or you said it was floating, it suspends. Is there something wrong? Or maybe it was supposed to suspend and it floats. Like, how can I get this? And talk to the maker. The maker, I would say, most of the time is going to do you justice, but you got to give them their fair due and give them time. That's the other thing. I respond, I send a message, I haven't heard from him yet. It's been 6 hours. Give a day, give a couple of days just in case, just because I'm not even like super, super, like big in the bait making world, but I can tell you that within the course of 12 hours, if I haven't talked to you, your DM is no longer in my page of DMs right when I open up Instagram. Like, I have to scroll down for it, and I'm not huge. So like, if you bought a bait from like a Throwback Baits or a Piz Baits, like, and these are in the bass world, like, I don't know if Hosers has got an Instagram, but like a Hosers bait.
No.
But I'm just saying, like, if you went to one of those big ones, like, if you sent a message, it could be like 4 hours and you're no longer on that front page. 24 hours later, they have to scroll to find you. So, like, just keep that in mind.
Well, there's a number of different reasons why somebody might not be able to get it, like their house burned down. to use a personal situation. But for most of us, it's not our primary means, and you have to give people the ability to lead their lives and, you know, get back into their garage, as they say, garage bait builders, to be able to respond to it. And then maybe they're working on the, you know, you most of the time people, if they've contacted me, they've kind of given me a rundown on what the issues are. Maybe I'm working on it, and I'm trying to find you a solution.
Right.
Before I even contact.
But I mean, that was a great question. And that's for the non-bait builders or the fishers getting a bait. At the same time, and this speaks to myself as well as you and anybody making baits, there's like the constant need to try to make the bait as good as possible is so important, I think. And I see people come in and make a cool looking bait, but they just want to push it off the shelf super quickly. Because again, I've mentioned this in a bunch of different episodes. All it takes is a couple people to hit you up on Instagram or Facebook and be like, dude, I need two of those. And you're like, okay. The chances of somebody ordering three of them and all three of them working the same, if you've only ever made two of them, it's low because you haven't kind of worked out those kinks yet, right? So I think that's really important to make sure that you're, and I'm confident with the baits that I make, especially the main lineup that I have, and I'm still self-conscious when I send them out in case they don't work the way that person expects it to work. So, I mean, it's a gentle dance. It's back and forth, but I do want to get into some of the main questions that I talked to everybody. Like, we've been talking for a bit now. Now it's time for the meat and potatoes. So I'm going to rapid fire the first one, which is bananas on boats. What do you feel about bananas on your boat?
Well, when we talked about talking about it, I said that I think it bleeds to or leads to my lack of confidence as a fisherman. I think I'm a better lure maker than I am a fisherman. So because when I don't really know, how about we err on the side of caution and keep the bananas off the boat. And then we alluded to the, I believe it was Gord that put out a blurb in one of his articles. Like he said, he included it as part of the article, but I think that there is a chemical compound. I think it's more in the banana peel than the banana itself that some species find distasteful.
Right.
So I guess if you've handled your banana too much and then you handled your bait, right. Maybe there's something to, you know, leading scent. So I would err on the side of not bringing a banana. Right. And then you mentioned banana chips. Yes. Oh, you know, I wouldn't kill the day because you brought banana chips on the boat, but
you're not saying necessarily that like bad juju. You're just saying that you're just, if there's a chance to make it a worse day, then why not just leave that one on the sideline?
That's right. You know, that there's other fruit, you know, I'd be less likely to bring an orange on the boat because those things are sticky and all of that. So I'd probably be more anti-orange than I would be anti-banana. But, you know, just because I just don't like getting my hands sticky from a juicy orange.
So,
but apples, you know.
Okay. Now, I mean, in the two nights that I stayed at your place, the only time I saw you go fishing was at midnight. So I don't know if this one's relevant to you, but I like to ask about different boat snacks.
Sure.
Excuse me. So I don't know if you're bringing boat snacks out at midnight, but what would your go-to boat snack be if you were to have one?
Well, I actually don't, anything salty. I don't have a specific go-to, but I mean, I might like, and I've, in all of your podcasts, I think somebody has mentioned, you know, some kind of salted meat of some sort. Mm-hmm. It'd be jerky. Jerky is probably one of my favorite things. Jerky and potato chips are the crack cocaine for Lawrence. So, like, often I get people, you know, I work as a postal carrier offering me a cookie. I can turn down cookies all day long. But I start twitching when somebody offers me something salty. So any you know, I'm dying to try that. What was it? A sausage. I don't even know what it was called. It was mentioned, like the second guy said, "Oh, I can't believe somebody else mentioned that salty snack." Because it's from Virginia, I think it was.
The one thing that I remember, that was a pepperoni roll or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm dying to try that. So if I can get on a boat with the couple of guys that suggested that, I'd love to try something like that because that kind of speaks to the savory, salty weakness. Definitely. So. But I mean, and then it would be a salty snack that maybe I'm not supposed to eat in the living room because the government makes too much mess. But you know, that's something salty, savory, whether it be potato chips or jerky, right, would be my choice.
Now, you, not your lures, what would you take for three? Now, I always preface this, I do it every single time, but I just mean like kind of like an always go-to lure for you? Like something that's always just been like your safety blanket lure. Three different lures that you would just never get rid of, that they would just be your thing.
Well, I think it would. I think that my first choice, and it's a lure that I started to make of my own. Doesn't have to be one of my own, but a spinnerbait of some sort. The first one that I end up, and let's just say maybe I'll choose that one. It's called a Pearson grinder. It's a spinnerbait. It's got a slightly shorter arm, so you can grind through weeds. But I mean, I think a spinnerbait is something that can be fished top of the column, bottom of the column, or rolled down. Right. And when you asked about it, it is really something. Philosophically, I'm trying to actually go away from confidence baits, yeah, and trying to be a confident fisherman, so that I am confident. Okay, my electronics are telling me the fish are here. Well, if I'm confident in a jitter walker, well, if they're 20 feet down, you know, maybe that's not the one. But you know, so but top three baits would probably be, especially with the musky side of things, would be a spinner bait, probably the Pearson grinder, not one of my own. It would then be a flat sided bait, crank bait, like a Grandma or a Jake, and then some kind of rubber. Swim bait, maybe a water wolf or a rover bait,
right,
because I like yourself trying to use,
yeah,
you know,
custom
bait maker, yeah, custom, yeah, made, you know, I've seen them both work phenomenally well. So, you know, and then to you know, use the bait from two great guys to make great baits. Yeah, those two rubber baits are always in my boat.
Okay, so I mean, I know you as a musky guy. I've talked to you pretty much strictly musky, and I know you do truly have a passion for musky, and I don't mean that from this podcast. I've known that from you over the last couple of years talking to you. But if you had three bucket list trips anywhere in the world, 24 hours per location, what would you fish for? What would be your bucket list trip?
Yeah, there's another kind of struggle. I think the top of the list is like so many people have mentioned, is a tarpon, just because it feels like a doable battle that you can do on your own. It speaks to me because of the, like, you're casting at them. You feel like it's kind of a hunt. At least I've never done it, so speaking from complete ignorance here. But I mean, and then, you know, to have a 80, 90, 100 pound tarpon jump out of the water, I can't think of anything like that more exciting. Even though there's more species of saltwater fish that could probably, you know, and then I would love someday to, a friend of mine owns an Amazon River guiding business, Mark Bolton, and to go with him to down to South America someplace and chase Payara. That kind of also kind of began from the first lure making videos with Larry Dahlberg talking about making these special lures. Yeah, he's got to be right up there as a goat for sure in the lure making world. Things with teeth like always really excite me. And then the last one, it'd be a difficult. I think I just, one of the most amazing videos that I saw is the Canal Gratis guys. They did a video about fishing pike in the land of the midnight sun in northern Sweden, I think it was. And they do this amazing footage, some of the best footage I've seen out of drones, where they're basically sight fishing. I think they're using flies most of the time, if not always. But that looks amazing, wow, you know. So, and then, yeah, so that
And I mean,
I think it's almost more for location than the fish.
That's what I was just about to say.
Because the other thing I'd love to go to Lake Baikal in Siberia, you know, the deepest lake in the world. It's, you know, deepest spotted, you know, a mile deep. It's got to be holding some unbelievable fish.
Well, that's what I was going to say, like bucket list fish. There's so many fish. And I mean, that's where I kind of went to, like, the same thing, going to the Amazon for Arapaima. Like, it's, the fish is fantastic, but the experience is fantastic, right? Like, it's part of the whole experience as well as the fish. Like, there's so, like you said, I was just talking to somebody about, it might even been you, about ocean fishing. And, like, to catch it's rare to catch a 2-pound fish. You know what I mean? Like, you're catching, like, bigger fish. I mean, I'm speaking out of turn because I've never done it. People are probably like, you idiot, you catch 2-pound fish all the time. But, like, in my, what I see is, like, even the small fish are pretty big compared to, like, a few ounce perch that you could pull off day on a dock, you know? So it's just, it interests me so much. So, but yeah, I mean, those are obviously fantastic. And like you said, with the pike fishing, it's, we have pike here, but it's that experience of getting that in it.
Yeah.
That's awesome, man. That's fantastic. Listen, I don't want to take any more of your time. We've been actually grinding at this for quite some time. But I do know that you set yourself up with you covered most of them. But did you have anybody else you wanted to shout out? Because I know that you were really adamant letting people know.
So far, I actually haven't mentioned, you know, my closest buddy in the lure making world, Doug Richardson, that he makes the Ugly Pike Bait Company. He actually was able to patent a design on his wagger baits. In the bass world, guys that are listening in should give the Ugly Pike Bait Company a look. In all species, none of the fish have seen a bait that works like the tail that he designed, that he has the patent on. They talk, you know, I think, well, in musky world anyways, the baits that have the new vibration, the new kind of thing, they have a tendency to be the hot bait kind of going. I think he's a modest individual that is exceptionally intelligent in so many areas, and his baits are phenomenal, I think. They're, you know, the combination of a hard bait that looks like it's swimming like a rubber, I think is exceptionally rare. So it'll speak to its durability. I think it'll speak to its fish catching ability.
I have two of them. One of them's like I think one's like 7-8 inch. And then he didn't have it at the time, but he makes like a 4 or 5 inch version. He makes a smaller version that he was telling me about.
Yeah, he makes a version that'll go back on the back of a jig. So like you can have a swim jig that has the tail. You can have like a hard bodied bait that has the tail. He makes a version that it ends up being a flat sided crankbait, kind of like a Jake, but then it has this tail on the back of it. So I think, I don't know, he, talking about a good guy in the business, he's definitely that. I think that anybody that is interested, like you said, that has a novel idea, well, would this tail work on X bait? You know, he would definitely be able to get you the answer to it all.
Right.
So, you know, I wanted to, you know, mention the guides that I have worked with to some degree, that I feel bad that I haven't gotten more baits out to them because of the personal challenges with the house and others. But I mean, Andrew Walker, Cast and Conquer, anybody that is looking for fish content, fishing content, whether it be the bass that we maybe went on too much about at the carp at the beginning. But I mean, he went to he represented Canada at the World Carping Championships in France last year. Wow. I believe he's going back again next year. He does great videos for muskie fishing. He may have the largest muskie ever caught through the ice. I think it was 51 or 52. He does the video is a phenomenal in that he cut a live well into the ice. So he mostly fishes for them, I think, and maybe only fishes for them when the air temperature is high enough, you know, so that it's not an issue for their eyes and this, you know, to be exposed to the elements when they're out of the water. But he does. And then my understanding is as well, you definitely can book them for next ice season, but he doesn't allow others to handle them unless he feels it's 100% safe for them to do so, because he's interested in the health of the fish.
Right.
So under those circumstances, like you got to look at the video of it. Jamie Sebastian is another guy that he does in Eastern Ontario. John Anderson that I mentioned earlier, I think anybody that knows Muskie knows he's as good as it gets. Darcy Cox, that is up on Lake of the Woods. Tank Industries, I believe, is the business.
Yep.
If you're looking them up, if you're looking Lake of the Woods, you know, he's second to none. Cal Ritchie is giving me a lot of great feedback. He's on Eagle Lake. Again, another guy that I think you'd be impossible to beat in set of the skills. A new friend that I've been able to fish with now a couple of times, John Cowan, that has been on Muskie Hunter TV with Jim Sarek. They're all individuals that, like, just being in the – I'm dying to be on the boat with the guys that I haven't been able to, because they can impart knowledge by just what – like a hook set from one of those guys. You can explain technique, but until you've seen, you know, Barry Bonds hit a ball, right. Like Barry Bonds can't explain to you how to hit a ball. Right. You have to see him do
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
And then you do your best to emulate that, and then that'll get you closer to where you want to go as a fisherman. Right. So, and then lastly, but not least, is Dan Beecroft, Slime Industries, that I've worked with a few times to promote his business on St. Clair. Runs a great business, has run my spinner baits, he's run some of my prototypes and other baits, and I can't be more thankful to them all for a little bit, and hopefully I can repay back with some more baits. And then lastly, I actually want to just kind of mention that I'm excited about a new bucktail. I ventured into the world of bucktails. I'm making it's called the Topspin. It's basically it started because I wanted to make an oversized one blade bucktail, but I was frustrated with the fact that it kept spinning in on itself. So I created a little arm on top of it. So it gets a number four blade on top of it. So you get the thump of a one bladed bucktail in a size 10 blade. I'm started making them in eights as well, and then the accidental part of it is that you can bend that arm so that the top blade can now make contact with it. So it tick, 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 as it's thumping when I fished it in good water, it managed to get my PB at 51 inches on the St. Lawrence. And maybe that was lucky, but then less than 45 minutes later, managed to get a 43.
That's phenomenal.
So 94 inches of fish in less than an hour. I gotta share this with others.
You sent me some pictures of it, and it is a very cool looking bait, and that's one of the fun things we get to play with, right? It's just the finding the happy accidents, to quote Bob Ross,
yeah,
and being able to manipulate them to work to our advantages.
Well, The honest truth is like the main three baits that I make, those three that we mentioned during the podcast, all kind of came. There's definitely an element of accident. The Jitterwalker, I started with a body that was too small. Whoops, here's a jointed bait. The Magician actually started from a failed walk the dog bait that I decided to cut the mouse design in it that is similar to a number of other baits. I didn't it ends up being a longer story, but I did it because others had complained that another friend of mine had made a bait that looked like that, and it was kind of like a middle finger up to you guys, because they're complaining that somebody copied it, and actually it walked better when I cut the mouth out to make it a dive rise, and then, you know, the top spin bait that actually I'll mention as well. Doug Richardson is going to be building the kind of like the dozer part of it, so you'll be able to buy from the Ugly Pike Company just the front end, so the blade and the ticker blade, the top spin blade from him, if you want to add it in front of rubber, if you want to add it in front of whatever other bait that you know, some people call them dozers, some people call them a variety of different names, add on the front of whatever baits to add some vibration. So No Man's an Island, and all of these individuals have played a part in the bait side of things. They've created greater fun, like yourself, meeting yourself, happenstance on somebody's celebrating, you know, an anniversary. We're here on a podcast 4 or 5 years
which
later.
Which is amazing, man. So
talking for too long.
No, this is perfect. And I mean, the problem is because again, it's just information, like we talked about it. So I could listen to you talk about things and pick out the information and people's names. And I know already I'm going to have to listen to this again when I'm editing it and pause it and take these names down. So I appreciate that. But one thing you haven't done yet is plugged where people can find you. Where can people actually look at your base?
Well, the best way to find me is either Lawrence Bendandy, Lawrence, just like the St. Lawrence River. Bendandy is Bendandi on Facebook. That's where most of the traffic is. Fish Whistle Lures. Actually, I should have written it down, but you can probably search Fish Whistle on Facebook as well. I try to make a separate lure group, even though I'm not that good at keeping that up as a separate thing. But that's the two best ways to kind of reach me, to take a look at the Facebook page in the pictures, and then start the dialogue for whatever the baits are, and I'll do my best to get them. I'm going to try to make them in batches and make them available. We've discussed that side of it. It's a little bit stressful for me to take an order, and I've decided to kind of
do small batch drops.
Get to a point where I'll do 5 to 10 of this and make it available. I'll take names down, and then with no money down, and then I'll contact you if you have I need
for sure.
Unusual patterns. I'll do my best to get to it when I can.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, listen, again, I appreciate your time. I appreciate you coming on here. I mean, I could do this in part 3, part 4, because our conversations go forever. So I will link your Facebook and your Instagram underneath the banner of this episode. So anybody looking for those, you'll find it there. Yeah. I will also take a couple pictures. I'll post them in my Made to Cast Instagram so that you guys can check out exactly what we're talking about with what Lawrence has been working on and what he has. I've seen them in the fish's mouth through pictures. I do know they work. I've seen great things. I do want to double up with Doug Richardson. I've met him last year at the Muskie Odyssey, and he's an absolute fantastic dude. So with that being said, last week I said I'd do a shout out series. I'm not going to go too crazy big because we've had a lot of shout outs already, but I do want to just, because we're in the Muskie world, people that I follow that I think you should follow. And these guys are in the Muskie world, and it's just, they're amazing people. They've helped me out, or I just like to see them. We got Metalhead Muskie Baits. We have DK Lures. We have Fret Hold Baits. And what was the last one? I had one more that I wanted to Shout out. Damn it. Now I feel bad. Oh, it wasn't a musky bait.
Well, you
didn't look. Wasn't a musky bait. It was rescue fishing. Yeah. Sorry. R-E-S-Q fishing. He finds stuff, used stuff, coffee can lids, whatever he's got. He finds these things, he puts them together, and he makes baits. He recycles his whatever he has, and he'll use like a hook and stuff. He doesn't make that, but he makes these flashy spinner baits, all that stuff. It's absolutely fantastic, and all with stuff that he's pulled out of the garbage. So make sure you're checking him out. Those three guys that I told you about. This episode also was brought to you by Paul's Bent Pole on Instagram. Go check him out. He's a big bait bass. I've had him on here. Big bait fisherman. Right now he's grinding all these workouts. He's extra motivational and delicious lately, but I brought it up to him and he said he's never going to cramp up throwing those big baits this year. So go check out Paul. For everybody else, thank you so much for listening. Thank you for the support as always. Thank you for the questions. Please send them more questions and ideas that you have. Otherwise, again, can't thank you enough for the support. I love you all. Until next time, be happy, healthy, and we'll see you on the water.